Welcome to the second season of the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. I'm Chase Maxwell. Twenty-two years ago, the Friends began a storytelling series for adults. What could be better than sitting by the fire, sipping a warm cup of coffee or cider, while listening to some of the best writers Minnesota has to offer? Over the years, the Fireside series has featured a great range of authors, from Kate DiCamillo to Jack Weatherford, Carol Bly to Marlon James, making the winter just that much more bearable. The 2016 season continues this great legacy of presenting Minnesota's best authors reading by the fire. After a great response last year, we've decided to continue podcasting the series in its entirety. Author Faith Sullivan returns to kick off the 22nd annual Fireside series with a reading from her new novel, Goodnight, Mr. Woodhouse, which celebrates the strength and resourcefulness of independent women, the importance of community, and the transformative power of reading. Sullivan is the author of 7 award-winning novels, including Goodnight, Mr. Woodhouse, Gardenias, The Empress of One, and The Cape Ann. She's also an indefatigable champion of literary culture and her fellow writers, and has visited with hundreds of book clubs. Born and raised in southern Minnesota, Faith Sullivan lives in Minneapolis with her husband. With that brief introduction, I'll turn it over to Faith Sullivan.
Thank you so much for that lovely introduction, and thank you to the Friends of the Library and to the librarians, the staff here at this library. Isn't this just one of your favorite libraries, honestly? My notes out, without which I'm dead, so. Mr. Woodhouse and I are both tickled pink to see so many of you here tonight. We're thrilled. I wanted to talk a little bit about what has come to be called the Harvester novels. Harvester is the town in which the books since the Cape Ann included, have been set. Well, I have to amend that a bit. The Gardenias was set for the most part in Southern California, but it was characters from Harvester. The first, of course, was the Cape Ann, and at the end of my writing that, my husband said, I think that you should write a sequel to this. And I liked that idea, but as I had been writing the book, I'd become fascinated with the Wheeler family. Sally was one of Lark's favorite friends, and it was obvious in the Cape Ann that Sally's mother was a severe depressive. And I was interested in how that worked family dynamic-wise with the husband having to step up to the bat and become father and mother to this little girl growing up. And would she grow up in a way that would either doom her or make it possible for her to have a good and happy life? One of the books that is set in Harvester but does not have characters from the others is a book called What a Woman Must Do. I hate that title, I'll tell you right off the top. I thought it was the worst title I ever heard of. When my publisher, which was Random House, was publishing the book, they didn't like the title I had chosen, which was the most appropriate title. It was called The Dog in the Manger, which, if you remember, the Aesop's fable, it is about a dog who is jealous of the cattle and does not want to let them lie down in the manger. And, well, anyway, they didn't like that. And so we ended up with What a Woman Must Do, which I do not claim as my own, believe me, I'll tell you. But be that as it may, it is another Harvester novel, but without the usual suspects in it. The way that this current book came about was that I had dealt with, and those of you who have read the other books, you know Mrs. Stillman, Hilly Stillman's mother, a third grade teacher all of her adult life virtually, and the mother of this lad that went off to World War I and came home mentally destroyed, really. And I had dealt with her, as I say, through several other books in one way or another, but in a very minor way, I think. And I knew that I wanted to tell her story because I knew that she had a much more interesting story than what we had been able to glimpse in the other books. And I wanted to bring that to people's attention. So as I began to write, I thought, however, this is a woman who really has a great deal of sadness and hardship in her life. And I don't want to write a book that's going to be such a downer that people are not going to get through it. So how can I, what can I do with this story to alleviate some of that? And I remembered that when my husband and I were living in Los Angeles, I belonged to a book group there. And one night, one of the women said to the others, "Is there any one author or any one book that has seen you through the hardest times?" And we sort of went around the circle, and one woman said that she had several daughters. She said, "I couldn't have gotten through my daughter's teenage years without Jane Austen." And we could all understand that. Somebody else mentioned Dickens, and I couldn't really think of a particular author who had seen me. I remember that I had been reading Crime and Punishment when my college fiancé and I broke up. And that seemed somehow appropriate. But it was not long after that I picked up my first Woodhouse book. And it was a Jeeves and Wooster, and I knew virtually immediately that this was the guy who was going to see me through dark times, and he has never let me down. And I recently had a note from someone, a reader, who said, you know, I've used him in the same way. I cannot pick up one of his books and stay in a bad mood or stay sad or whatever, because it's total escape in the moment and total laughter. And I came to love him so much that when I was going to write about Mrs. Stillman, I thought, aha, this is going to be her escape. This is going to be her salvation, that she has got this wonderful writer to turn to. So that's how it all sort of came together. I'm going to be reading a little bit, some excerpts from the book. And for those of you who have been to other readings of mine, I'm sorry if you're hearing the same thing twice. It happens that way sometimes. Okay. In 1944, at the age of 68, Nell Stillman wrote her obituary. This despite perfectly good health. Years later, the owner of the Standard Ledger published the piece in full. Quote, "In our town, the custom is that an obituary should be kind. A kind word at the end is a little reward for dying." "Never mind that no one spoke well of you before death." "Nor will hence. Death is a serious business. The undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveler returns. And this one time you are owed." But frankly, Helen Ryan Stillman was no better than she ought to be. So contrary to custom, I will not reward her for dying. On October 12, 1876, Helen, Nell as she was called, was born in Woodbridge, Wisconsin, to shanty Irish immigrants, affectionate and gentle Annie and Donald Ryan, late of Tipperary. Donald being an untutored farmer on unimproved land, the family struggled with poverty. After high school, Nell worked her way through Milwaukee State Normal School, obtaining teacher certification in 1896. In 1897, she married Herbert Bartholomew Stillman of Rhinelander, Wisconsin. they moved to Harvester, settling in an apartment above Rabel's Meat Market, where Nell would reside until her death. On December 18, 1898, she gave birth to Hilliard Donald Stillman, a soul without stain. He now dwells in Elysian Fields, where, should it mean swimming the length of the River Styx, Nell plans to join him. In 1909, Nell discovered P.G. Woodhouse, who became her treasured companion and savior. She recommends his books to all who know distress and, of course, to all who don't. But further, she simply commends reading Dickens, Austen, Steinbeck, or whom you will. In books are found solace, companionship, entertainment, and enlightenment, the stuff of our salvation. Mrs. Stillman taught third grade for 37 years in the Harvester Public School. Preceded in death by both husband and son, Nell knew the kindness of dear friends and eventually the love of a good man. End quote. For days, folks in Harvester spoke of little but Nell's obituary. Bonita Hansen had never heard of Elysian Fields, nor of the River Styx. Of course, even today, mass communication notwithstanding, there are many things of which people in Harvester have never heard. Irma Blessing felt that the obituary was eccentric, a sign of mental instability. I blame it on the bomb. But to Harvey Munson, it was more like egomania. Imagine thinking that you were smarter than Mr. Estes at the Standard Ledger, writing your own obituary. Eventually, the love of a good man? What's that supposed to mean? Milkman Casey Birnbaum wondered. Out in Elysian Fields, Nell agreed. Perhaps composing her own obituary was eccentric and egotistical. But as for Elysian Fields, look it up. Okay. In 1909, now it's when she discovers, Woodhouse. On an October afternoon when the air was extravagant with the scent of bonfires and apples, Hilly joined Nell to walk home from school, stopping at the Water and Power Company on their way. Now, the fact is that in 1909, this little community didn't have a library, but the Lundeen family, who had money, provided a huge bookcase in the Water and Power Company, and anybody who had finished reading a book and wanted to share it would leave it there, or a magazine, or whatever. Nell spied a book high on a shelf titled Love Among the Chickens by someone named P.G. Woodhouse, a book left there by Cora, as it turned out. As though bewitched, Nell sighed, ah, yes, and pulled the book down. Well, one doesn't often come across a title like that, she thought. While Hilly leafed through an illustrated Wild West magazine from a lower shelf, Nell opened the volume and read. The scene selected at random took place on a golf course. The narrator recounted, I drove off from the first tee. It was a splendid drive. I should not say so if there were anyone else to say it for me. But as there is not, there is no one, I must repeat the statement. Later, dawdling along Main Street and casting an eye into store windows at goods she couldn't afford, an irrational giddiness shook Nell and her hand fluttered to her throat. Love among the chickens. Mr. Woodhouse, it turned out, was entirely a new experience. He was delicious, lighter than air, generous to a fault. He made her laugh as no man ever had. Surely he wrote only for her. His rhythms, the way his wit kissed a phrase and sent it dancing, these warmed her like summer. She laughed aloud and fell in love again and again. Since she had a great hunger to feel weightless and amused, to dismiss out of mind grubby envelopes and school boards and men who breezed off to state legislatures, Mr. Woodhouse came to live with her. No, she went to live with him. He was a friend who took her hand, saying, "I'll show you an innocent place, and I'll be there when you need me." A gentle man. Other than that extra card from Juliet's desk, wishing you luck in cards and love, never had Nell stolen anything. But she did not return Love Among the Chickens to the Water and Power Company, and later she would filch The Swoop. And should any other volumes by Mr. Woodhouse fall into her hands, well, they would meet the same fate. Now, if you have read the book, or even if you haven't, you maybe are aware of the fact that during World War II, Woodhouse got into great difficulties with the English. He and his wife were living in France when it was invaded by the Germans, and the Germans took Woodhouse captive and kept him in a, well, it was a camp sort of like we would describe where white-collar executives are sent for some naughtiness. In other words, treated very well, considering. And eventually they moved him from there, and his wife as well, to almost a castle up in the mountains of Germany, away from any contact. He had no idea that the Jews were being rounded up and sent off to concentration camps. He had no idea that London was being nightly bombed by German planes. And so the Germans said to him, "Well, why don't you make little radio broadcasts back to your homeland while you're captive here?" And he, being the kind of innocent person that he was, and he was a total innocent, agreed to that. Well, people back in England who were being bombed every night during the Blitz did not take well to hearing broadcasts from somebody in Germany who was an Englishman and telling them how well he was being treated by his captors. So at the end of the war, he was not welcome. In fact, many people wanted to try him as a traitor in England. And he spent most of the rest of his life in the United States. But I had tried over the years before I saw a recent movie. There is a movie, I don't know if it was made for television or if it was regular movie, called Woodhouse in Exile, which so beautifully illustrates. It's a wonderful little movie, wonderful movie with a wonderful sort of a masterpiece theater type cast to it, and illustrates that kind of almost unbelievable innocence that the man had virtually all his life. He was so focused, which you would have to be. He wrote 92 books. He wrote musical comedies. He wrote dozens and dozens of short stories. He was just a writing machine. And that was the way his mind worked, on that little narrow path of his humor. He didn't care about politics, nothing outside of that writing world in which he lived. He and his wife lived in a house on Long Island, very quiet. I mean, he would go into the city to work with people he was working, who were his partners on musical comedies, but then immediately back again out to the house and their dogs. And that was their little world, that house and his writing and their dogs. So eventually, it became known down deep in their blood vessels, if you will, in England, how innocent this man was. He was not a traitor. He was not all the things that they had. He was actually knighted, but he was not comfortable after the way he had been treated. And you could not really blame the English either. They didn't know him well enough to understand him. But anyway, during that time, Nell writes a letter to him because her friend Eudora, who is a great Anglophile, is so upset when she gets the news that he is making these broadcasts to England. Dear Mr. Woodhouse, I'm sending this in care of your publisher, hoping that by some miracle it finds you. I feel as if I were posting a letter to the moon. My friend Eudora, who is a great Anglophile, tells me that you are in trouble in England because of your broadcasts from Germany. I write to assure you that I do not believe you are a collaborator. My companions, the Earl of Emsworth, Aunt Dahlia, and Jeeves, that wisest of the wise, assure me that Eudora is quite wrong. I am far more inclined to believe them than those who are carried away in a moment of hysteria. Thanks to another old friend, I have to date 33 of your volumes, beginning with Love Among the Chickens. Over the years, my little world has shrunk, as little worlds are inclined to do. Among those lost was the friend who year after year delighted me with your books. However, that friend kindly provided funds and connected me with a bookseller so that I might be kept current. I remind that dealer to notify me the moment you publish each of your life-saving works. You may regard life-saving as extravagant. I do not. When my son Hilliard was in France during the Great War, your books helped to sustain me. And when he came home from that war shattered, I could not have endured the nights of worry without your help. In more recent days, Hilliard took his own life. Though my friends have been kind, escape from grief was rare. How would I have survived without your people carrying me away to Shropshire and holding my hand in the sunlight of that place? And Lord Emsworth's Empress, that delightful pig, well, she even moved me to laugh out loud. So you see, dear Mr. Woodhouse, no one will ever convince me that you have sided with the Nazi savages. As we say around here, you have been buffaloed. It is crucial that you go on saving lives and sanity as you have mine. Hoping this will one day reach you, I remain a faithful and grateful friend, Nell Stillman. And eventually she does get a letter back from him after quite some time, and a beautiful letter it is too. I won't read that tonight, but you'll have to read the book by then. I'm going to read you the afterword to this novel. I wanted to have something to say about what I had been doing and what my intentions were and so forth, and my publisher very kindly agreed to let me do that. Beginning with The Cape Ann, I wrote a series of Harvester novels, The Empress of One, What a Woman Must Do in Gardenias. In All But One, What a Woman Must Do, Mrs. Stillman, the protagonist of Goodnight, Mr. Woodhouse, played a crucial role in the lives of those around her. And yet I think she would describe herself as quite ordinary. If there is indeed a figure such as every man, then Mrs. Stillman is every woman. Wife, mother, widow, friend, lover, mystic. Teacher, reader. I wish to emphasize reader because throughout her adult life, Nell Stillman falls back upon literature in order to survive the losses, humiliations, and mysteries to which we are all heir. Since I have been for 40 years an ardent fan of P.G. Woodhouse, and since I saw in his artful and noble nonsense an anodyne to pain, I thought it appropriate to combine the needs of Nell Stillman with the gifts of Woodhouse. In doing so, I hope to honor both. It is rare that a writer of fiction finds the opportunity to celebrate an author much loved in her own life. It has been my privilege to do so, and at the same time to celebrate the power of literature to comfort, enlighten, entertain, transform, and doggone it, make us just more fun to be around.
We've reached one of the best parts of the Fireside series, the Q&A with the author and our dedicated audience at Hamlin Midway Library. It's a chance to go beyond the book, connecting readers and writers on a deeper level. To make it easier for you, the listener, I've summarized the questions and we'll read them. First up, an audience member asked why Sullivan chose to begin the story with the obituary of the novel's main character, Nell Stillman. Was there a certain aspect of the plot that demanded it?
Well, the reason I put the obituary at the beginning is because I wanted to start with one of the low points in Nell's life, which was her husband dying, and she has got 65 cents in a jar in the kitchen and a child, a baby, to look after. And starting there meant that I didn't get to Woodhouse until like 150 pages in. And I wanted, especially since the book is called Goodnight, Mr. Woodhouse, I wanted to introduce him earlier on. And that was one way that I could do it and give you a heads up that this is going to be somebody important to this character. But that's a very good question, yeah.
Next up, an audience member asked how long it took Sullivan to complete the novel.
Well, it took me 10 years. Most of the other books that I have written had taken me 2-3 years, and this one, I think it was for a couple of reasons. Number one, never before had I covered such a length of time as I did in this book. And number two, because it was going to be an homage to Woodhouse. I mean, when you take it upon yourself to write something like that for a novel, a writer as famous as Woodhouse, you want to make sure that when you're done, you've done him some service. You don't want to come away and have Woodhouse fans say, oh, for crying out loud, she might have, well, saved herself the trouble, you know? And so I just kept caressing it and caressing it and caressing it, trying to give him what was his due, in my opinion, anyway.
Following that question, an audience member asked about Lark Earhart, one of Nell Stillman's friends in the novel and an important character. Does Sullivan plan to continue Lark's story arc in future books?
Yes, I do. The book that I'm currently working on is not part of that, but I have actually a few chapters of the book on Lark as a grown-up, which will be coming down the line, God willing.
Next up, an audience member asked about the research required to write the novel. Did Sullivan read all of Woodhouse's books and assorted writings before completing her own novel?
Well, I confess I didn't read every single one. I think I do have them all, but I would, and I've read a large body of his work, so that it was mostly a matter of going back and picking this book out and, you know, finding that scene and so forth. If I had the time, I would go through them, the whole works, and all 92 of them.
The next question is specifically about Woodhouse. Did he ever write for magazines?
Oh, yes. Liberty, Saturday Evening Post, whoever would hire him, he would, yes, absolutely. And he was paid well because he was very popular.
They probably don't know. Liberty Magazine.
She asked if he was in Liberty Magazine. Well, that's before your time, some of you. Not before my time, but before some of you, anyway.
Following that question, an audience member asked about one of Sullivan's previous novels, The Cape Ann. In that book, Sullivan references two children's books. Were they based upon real books, or were they invented by Sullivan?
No, okay. They were not. They were my invention, yes. Sometimes you have to make up books that serve a certain need. Well, this reminds me that in Gardenias, when Lark and her mother and her Aunt Betty are on their way to California. On the train, she not exactly meets, but she sees this incredibly gorgeous woman whom those who see her say, well, she's got to be number one, a movie star, or, you know, somebody famous. And her name was Alicia Armand. And then indeed, as we go through World War II with Lark, she goes to the movies and sees Alicia Armand, who had been a ballerina in Europe and then emigrated to the United States because of the war. And my agent called me up when he read the manuscript, and he said, I have looked everywhere to find out something about Alicia Armand, and I cannot find her anywhere. Even my agent. Yeah. Dear man, dear man.
Next up, we have another research question. Does Sullivan conduct all of her own research, and does she read small town newspapers to get a sense of small town life?
Well, this is a confession. Now, don't go back to Lakefield and tell them I said this, okay? For years and years, I took the Lakefield Standard. And then last year, it had gotten so religious, I just couldn't deal with it anymore, and I stopped taking it. But I still take the Pipestone paper, and I used to take the St. Croix Falls paper, but I dropped that. Now I just have one small town newspaper. But I like to keep in touch through small town newspapers with, you know, is that still the kind of world that it was when I lived there? And I find that it pretty much is, except for the drug problem, which seems to have infected every small community in the state, I swear. Otherwise, small town life is pretty much small town life.
Following that question, an audience member discusses her affection for Woodhouse, particularly Jeeves and Wooster. In response, Sullivan provides a few recommendations of places where Woodhouse fans can find more of his work, including on film and television.
Anybody who is the tiniest bit interested in Woodhouse, you can get, you can rent the series from PBS of Jeeves and Wooster. And you know, if you see that, you don't ever want any other actor playing Jeeves or Wooster. Yeah, because they nailed it right on the head of the nail. And those are not easy parts to do that with. And you can get that through like Amazon or Netflix or whatever. Yeah. And also that other one that I mentioned, Woodhouse in Exile. If you want to know more about Woodhouse, that's available, right?
Finally, an audience member describes Sullivan's novel as an ode to how books can transport readers to different worlds. Are there any books that have had this similar effect on Sullivan? Books that she turns to when she's in a particular state of mind?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's really good. You know, I'm a little bit like Nell in that regard, that in the past, before I discovered Woodhouse, there were authors that I would turn to in bad times merely because, like with The Crime and Punishment, they were so dark, so awful, that when I would close them after reading for a little while, I'd say, well, at least that's not me. So sometimes that does work also. In that case, Balzac is a very good place to turn. Anyone else? Otherwise, we will close it off. You have been just so kind and wonderful as an audience. I thank you for being here, for being so welcoming, so receptive. Thank you.
You've been listening to the second season of the Fireside Podcast, presented by the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. Next week, author and veteran journalist Rick Shefchik discusses his new book, Everybody's Heard About the Bird, the true story of 1960s rock and roll in Minnesota. Until then, we hope you consider supporting the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library and its mission, Stronger Libraries for Stronger Communities. Learn more at thefriends.org. Follow us on Twitter at The Friends and on Facebook at facebook.com/friendsofsppl. Please consider subscribing to this podcast on iTunes.